Someone to Watch Over Me was written for the 1926 Gershwin musical O.K., a production starring Gertrude Lawrence. The song is the emotional high point of the entire show, a song in which Kay discovers and acknowledges, first indirectly and then directly, her own loneliness and insecurity. It's the quintessential ballad of self-discovery, and so I was amazed to discover, doing research, that the song originally wasn't a ballad at all. Ira explains, quote, "As originally conceived by the composer, this tune would probably not be around much today. At the piano, in its early existence, it was fast and jazzy, and undoubtedly I would have written it up as another dance and ensemble number. One day, for no particular reason, and hardly aware of where he was at, George started and continued it in a comparatively slow tempo, and half of it hadn't been sounded when both of us had the same reaction. This was really no rhythm tune, but rather a wistful and a warm one." You know, one of the most striking things about musical theater songs of the 20s, 30s, and 40s is that, with rare exceptions, we're used to hearing only half of the songs. Nearly all of these songs began with complete and often elaborate introductions, usually referred to as verses. In a sense, these introductions, often in a freer rhythm than the choruses, were the music theater world's equivalent to the recitatives that generally preceded arias in operas and operettas. The recitatives, in freer, more speech-like rhythm, set the scene for the arias that followed, but of course, it's the arias that became famous, not the recitatives. And by and large, it's the choruses of Gershwin's Porter's Kerns and Rogers' shows that actually became famous, not the verses. However, in many cases, the entire meaning and feel of the song is completely changed without hearing the verse. And the complex introduction to Someone to Watch Over Me is a kind of a miniature masterpiece without which the rest of the song is infinitely less poignant. So here are the first 8 measures of the introduction.
There's a saying old says that love is blind. Still, we're often told, seek and ye shall find. So I'm going to seek a certain lad I've had in mind.
How many of you have heard this part of the song before? Oh, a lot of musical theater aficionados out there. Good. Now, the arch, witty, articulate language of the lyrics. There's a saying old. Notice the reverse word order. Not there's an old saying. But there's a saying old, says that love is blind, still we're often told, seek and ye shall find. Starts the song off in that cosmopolitan world that Ira's characters often seem to inhabit. And the tone is light and literate, we ease into the song's journey, and rhythm is actually the key to the music. The melodic fragment of there's a saying old and says that love is blind are actually identical. And Gershwin could easily have repeated the fragment identically twice, like this. We'll sing it, and then you copy.
There's a saying old, says that love is blind.
A little sing-songy head movement helps. Here we go, ready? And
there's a saying old, says that love is blind.
But Gershwin repeats the phrase early as a syncopation and changes chords 3 times in unexpected places. So not... same melody, but here's Gershwin's version.
There's a saying old says that love is blind.
He then uses those exact same notes a 3rd time. So we've had, same thing. He does it again for still we're often told, but what makes it great is that the chords underneath all 3 versions are different, showing us a different side to her personality. The first one was this. Then the exact same melody, but different chords for say that love is blind. And then listen to this exquisite chord for Still We're Often Told. Same melody. I mean, the chords are the key to the emotion here. And the all-important message is, listen to me. I am what's important. Okay. Now, after doing that fragment 3 times, he then does the same fragment higher for Seek and Ye Shall Find, like this.
Seek and ye shall find.
And now the advice gets turned into action. Kay is going to actually do some seeking, and the music swoops up for So I'm Going to Seek. And after that constricted melody, remember, everything has just been this. Suddenly there's an enormous drive as we swoop up to describe her seeking like this.
So I'm going to seek.
And listen to the chords on In and Mind to finish the thought like this.
A certain lad I've had.
Listen to this one.
In mind.
Listen to the pain in that minor chord. Now, though the music repeats, the text deepens the mood and adds a whole new dimension to Kay's character like this.
Looking everywhere, I haven't found him yet.
The big affair.
He's the big affair, I cannot forget.
So we start to see that this seeking is pretty important. He's the big affair, I cannot forget. And then the next line confirms it. He's the only man she ever thinks of with regret. The only one, at least she only has one. Okay, like this.
Only a man I ever think of with regret.
Here's the regret. But now she puts herself together. But the orchestra shows the regret beneath the put together surface. Now, this is my favorite part. She tries to retreat to wit, not a kind of crass popular song, which would be something like, I want him, I need him, I need to feel his body, but instead, something like, I'd like to add his initial to my monogram. I mean, is that not perfect? Not I want him, not I need him, not I want to marry him. I'd like to add his initial to my monogram. That is the essence of Ira Gershwin's literate wit. There is an entire world in that one lyric, like this.
I'd like to add his initial to my monogram.
But then the piano starts to deepen the emotion, and then the true essence of Ira immediately followed by complete vulnerability and honesty, like this.
Tell me. Shepherd for this lost lamb.
And now we're in the place psychologically where she can actually begin to sing. We've already traveled in this introduction from the world of literate, witty, light banter, the world of the Roaring Twenties, to the world of emotional truth and honesty, our world as much as hers. And now she begins to sing to and for all of us.
There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone who'll watch over me.
Now this first measure is already filled with wonderful touches. After descending a scale to end the introduction, the end of the introduction is really this. See if you can hear that in. After descending down a scale, the thought of the man she's longing to see causes her to rise up an entire octave in the first measure, like this. Now, the harmony here is beautiful and actually harks back to Beethoven and the classical period in which this formula, Lebewohl in the Leser Just Sonata, this formula in the classical period signifies loss and absence. And as she rises in that traditional formula, one note in the left hand makes all the difference. Listen first to the fourth note I play in my left hand. I bet you didn't think you'd be coming here hearing. Listen very closely to the fourth note in my left hand. But listen to it. Here's a normal version. Normal here. But the last chord has one surprising dissonance, and that makes it great. Instead of, his version is, and then classic Gershwin, how could one figure so perfectly capture longing like this?
Longing to see.
Notice, he didn't do longing to see, but the syncopation is like a beating heart. Longing to see. Then he does it lower. Now notice there's always a second different chord in each figure, extra emotion as the second chord adds depth. We've done it here, now we do it lower down here. Change chords. And it keeps repeating lower and lower, as if having reached the height of longing, she turns back, knowing that it can never be. Each version more poignant than the one before. We've done it here. We do it lower. Here comes the third one, the most poignant of all.
Turns out to be.
Now watch. He could have then done one more. He keeps those notes, but stretches them out, setting up the magic leap up on watch like this.
Someone.
Here's the leap.
Will watch.
It's a leap up to where someone is watching. They're watching up there on that high note, and they're watching over the low note down here.
Over me.
They're watching, but maybe not. Now, notice the beautiful, effortless four inner rhymes in there. See, he, be, me. There's somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone who will watch over me. Four effortless inner rhymes. Of course, how many measures is it? The A? Eight measures. One, there's somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone who will watch over me. Bum. Second A section, identical music, but the beautifully shifts from a description of him to one of herself. I'm a little lamb who's lost in the woods, keeping that shepherd imagery thing going. I know I could always be good. Three inner rhymes, lost in the wood, could, good. Now, what comes next after A plus A? B. All right, now, the lyrics of this B section are classic. This goes by fast, and I want to make sure you do not miss it. Who but Ira Gershwin could rhyme the two separate words man and some with handsome? Listen to this.
Although he may not be the man some girls think of as handsome.
I mean, isn't that worth the price of admission, I tell you. But not only is the rhyme elegant and it's fantastic, George uses the same two melody notes three times on man some, think of, and handsome. The first two are harmonized the same way, like this. Man some, think of, but the third one is different. It's handsome. Now listen to that in context and see if you can hear it.
Although he may not be the man some girls think of.
And now watch this subtlety. Listen very closely. Listen closely to the chords under To My Heart.
To My Heart.
He carries are the same three melody notes. He could have used the same chords like this.
He carries.
But he changes the harmony on carries. So instead of this, here's what he does on carries. And she falls back again in resignation. And the final A section changes nothing musically whatsoever, but the words are amazingly poignant. Won't you tell him, please, to put on some speed? Hurry, she's begging him. Follow my lead. And then finally, the most openly confessional, naked admission of the whole song, oh, how I need. And then she becomes our representative, asking for the most universal thing of all, for someone to watch over me. Someone, now watch this. Remember this watching note up here. Sing that note on la.
La.
That's the watching note. Remember that. That's the watching note. And though the voice ends in resignation down low, down here, the piano rises to finish. Sing me your la note again. So where does the piano finish? Up there where someone is watching, though she may not know it, the piano has found her man. And now, from the 1926 musical, Okay, Someone to Watch Over Me.
Saying old says that love is blind. still we're often told, seek and ye shall find. So I'm going to seek a certain lad I've had in mind. Looking everywhere, haven't found him yet. He's the big affair I cannot forget. Only a man I ever think of with regret. I'd like to add his initial to my monogram. Tell me, where is the shepherd?
Of Thee I Sing, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 1932, is one of three satirical musicals that the Gershwins would write with George S. Kaufman. As the Depression deepened, these works satirized corporate and political leaders and institutions in ways that were new for musical comedy on Broadway. And this inspired new kinds of songs in forms other than the 32 bar forms that we've heard so far. In 1942, Ira wrote a letter to Kurt Weill about the show's opening a decade earlier. Quote, "We were in the midst of the worst depression the country had ever known. And at the same time, George and I had the biggest hit we had ever had. It actually ran for 441 performances, which for them was a huge hit. I felt then that it was a tough period for any new show unless it was so extraordinary that it could overcome the prevailing tone of gloom." Now, this show was a combination musical comedy love story with a satirical comment on it and the triviality and vacuousness of politics all at the same time. Music theater historian Tommy Krasker wittily describes the essence of this absurd plot. Quote, "Of Thee I Sing opens on an election year in the early 1930s as National Party campaigners herald their presidential nominee, John P. Wintergreen. Inside the campaign suite, however, party committee members are less than jubilant. Public trust in the party is low, especially since they just sold Rhode Island. And their candidate's only qualification is his presidential-sounding name. A newspaperman suggests they adopt a platform that, quote, everybody's interested in and that doesn't matter a damn. what could be better than a platform based on love, already a national obsession? Plans are laid. The party will sponsor a beauty contest in Atlantic City, and Wintergreen will marry the winner at the inauguration. Love is sweeping the country is Wintergreen staff's ode to the rousing electoral power of love. Now, the beginning of this sets the mood instantly to convey the mood of questions asked but unanswered. The music starts unsettled as to key, and it refuses to resolve like this.
Why are people gay all the night and day, feeling as they never felt before?
Now, with this simple melody, Gershwin could easily have used settled, stabled, nice, comfortable chords like this. But instead, he uses these dissonant, unstable ones like this. He then starts to repeat the idea higher, a standard Gershwin device. If he had copied it exactly higher, it would have only lasted two measures and it would have gone like this. But instead, it pushes further and still without a resolution like this.
Feeling as they never felt before.
Then still more questions. First questions up here.
What is the thing?
Then questions down here.
That makes them sing.
The whole phrase then starts to repeat like this.
Rich man, poor man, thief. Doctor, lawyer, chief.
Now, an exact repeat would go up like this, and particularly notice the last chord in this short example.
Feel a feeling that they can't ignore.
But instead, Gershwin's last chord is a complete shock, and it takes us to a surprising key. Shifting keys like this is almost unprecedented in a Broadway introduction. So not this last chord, but listen to his version.
That they can't ignore.
Now, watch the excitement grow as we take a tiny fragment like this.
It plays a part.
That fragment goes higher like this.
In every heart.
Still higher like this.
And every heart is shouting encore.
Which leads to the chorus, or A, and how many measures long do you think that is? 8. The evening has been a success. And
love is sweeping the country.
Are hugging the shore.
All the sexes from Maine to Texas have never known such love before.
How many of you know this song? Oh, a few of you actually do. Very good. As is so often the case, rhythm is the source of the music energy. If I remove Gershwin's syncopations, the whole opening becomes dull and lifeless. They sing and then you copy dull and lifelessly. Ready, and
love is sweeping the country.
Try that. Ready, sing.
Love is sweeping the country.
If you move your head on each beat, it gets even worse. Try that one more time. Ready, sing.
Love is sweeping the country.
Now we're going to add Gershwin's syncopation like this. Ready, and
love is sweeping the country.
Try that. Ready, sing.
Love is sweeping the country.
Then the same rhythm pushed higher like this.
Waves are hugging the shore.
Now watch this fantastic phrase. I'm going to very quickly build it up from trivial to great in 4 steps with you. At heart, the pattern of this melody couldn't be simpler. It's simply 2 notes. That's it. Lower and lower and lower. This is not great. Now I'm going to add a left-hand bass line, which is going to go down in a chromatic scale. For non-musicians, chromatic scale is simply a scale that moves from each note to the next nearest key, black or white. Chromatic scale. It's kind of the scale you get when you actually dust your piano, you know. Now, putting just the melody and the bass together. Each of them by themselves are not great. The melody, simple. The bass. Now I'm going to add Gershwin's wonderful chords in between the melody and the bass, but still without Gershwin's rhythm. This is pretty good, but still not great.
All the sexes, Maine to Texas.
But adding Gershwin's rhythm turns it into fantastic like this. Ready, and
all the sexes from
from Maine to Texas have never known such love before.
Having finished our 8 bars of A, I just want to make sure that you actually believe me. Love is sweeping the country, waves are hugging the shore, all the sexes from Maine to Texas have never known such love before. 8 bars. I want you, every time you hear a Broadway song, to be going, 5, 6. Like earlier songs, what should happen next? A, repeat of A, and it does start to repeat A, for see them billing and cooing like this. And
see them billing and cooing.
If he had copied A for like the birdies above, it would have sounded like this. And
like the birdies above.
But now things are so exciting, and the birdies are up so high that the music leaps up to do the phrase up here. Not here, but all the way up here like this. And
like the birdies above.
But now, totally new music. Instead of continuing to repeat A, we have an utterly new idea in pairs. First, a minor version like this.
Each girl and boy alike.
And then a major version like this.
Sharing joy alike.
The whole combination gets repeated.
Feels that passional soon be national.
That's the other fantastic rhyme in the show, and I want to make sure you get it. Who but Ira Gershwin, follow closely, would take the two words passion will, turn it into a contraction, passion ol, passion apostrophe LL, and rhyme passional with national. I mean, that is Ira Gershwin in a nutshell. And though that actually makes 8 measures, there's still more. A return to the opening idea, which you remember originally sounded like this, and you sang so beautifully. Ready, and
love is sweeping the country.
It's now transformed to this version. Ready, and
love is sweeping the country.
And listen to these wonderful bluesy minor chords on was and much. 1, 2.
There never was so much.
Now, originally, that was the entire song. No B section whatsoever, just A section and then that highly varied A section. But Ira goes on to explain, quote, shortly after this song was completed, I thought it could stand a patter section. George reflected a moment and said, quote, let's use the patter music from the East is West opening. We'd written a quite elaborate opening for that unproduced opus. At one stage in it, just before the love boat arrived, with its bevy of sing-song girls to be auctioned off, can see why this was an unperformed opus, a quartet of mandarins sang their preferences, and that's why the music to the present patter, slightly changed from the original, sounds a touch Chinese. Now, here's the basic melody of the patter section, which is just a short fragment immediately repeated. Repeated. Now, I'm not sure that really sounds Chinese in any way, but then again, I'm not sure that Madame Butterfly sounds Japanese either. In any case, repeating the harmony for both halves would sound like this.
Spring is in the air.
Repeat.
Each mortal loves his neighbor.
Listen closely. Instead of repeating the second half like that, same chord, Gershwin changes the last chord to change keys like this.
Each mortal loves his neighbor.
He then does the same music in a new key, already quite unusual for a Broadway song, but there's more. Here would be an exact repeat in the new key like this.
Who's that loving pair? That's capital and labor.
But instead, what we get is this.
Who's that loving pair? That's capital and labor.
With that lovely capital and labor, happy in love, church-like music at the end. Now, to be honest, this section contains lots of topical references that were current at the time, but I have to say are pretty obscure today. At heart, all you have to know is that they're pairs of enemies who now, because love is sweeping the country, have become friends. So suddenly, capital and labor, management and workers, the New York Times and its arch rival at the time, the New York Graphic, Ford and Chevrolet, the Cabots and the Lodges have now become loving pairs, and he saves the most important incompatible pair for last in an even more remote key like this.
Florida and California get together in a festival of oranges and weather.
And then without any seam, the music returns to repeat the entire chorus with a full chorus, which, unless you happen to know the words, but if you do, feel free to join in, for tonight will have to be Sally and Michael. Now, before we finish this portion of the program with the performance of this piece, I just want to offer you one quick final thought. Between 1918 and 1937, when George died at the tragically young age of 38, the Gershwin brothers produced over 700 songs for theater and film. A staggering number of these have become classics recorded and performed by generations of performers with no end in sight. But why? What has made these songs survive? Like all great art, which manages somehow to be both of its time and for all time, Gershwin tells us about America then, but about all of us now as well. 80 years after his death, we are all still, at the end of the day, in our most private moments, Gershwin, heroes and heroines, fragile and vulnerable, doing the best we can, trying to find our way, looking for love. Somehow, in a Gershwin musical, everything always seems to work out in the end, or if it doesn't, you at least get to sing a fantastic song about it. Which, if you think about it, isn't really such a bad philosophy of life. Accept what happens in life for better or for worse. Say yes to it all, but no matter what, always find a way to sing. We now finish the pre-tumultuous applause, pre-Q&A, pre-potential encore at the end of the Q&A portion of the program with Love is Sweeping the Country from the 1931 musical of The I Sing, music by George, lyrics by Ira.
Why are people gay all the night and day, feeling as they never felt before?
What is the thing that makes them sing?
Rich man, poor man, thief, doctor, lawyer, chief,
feel a feeling that they can't ignore.
It plays a part in every heart, and every heart is shouting encore.
Love is sweeping the country.
Waves are hugging the shore.
All the sexes from Maine to Texas have never known such love before.
See them billing and cooing like the birdies above.
Each girl and boy alike sharing joy alike feels that passional soon be national.
Love is sweeping the country. There never was so much love.
Spring is in the air. Each mortal loves his neighbor.
Who's that loving pair? That's capital and labor.
Chevrolet and Ford have felt this cosmic urging.
They with one accord have kissed and now are merging.
Florida and California get together in a festival of oranges and weather.
Boston's upper zones are changing all their habits, and I hear the cones are taking up the Cabots.
Taxi men take dimes and never curse the traffic, while the New York Times adores the New York graphic.
Love is sweeping the country. Waves are hugging the shore. All the sexes from Maine to Texas have never known such love before. See them billing and cooing like the birdies above.
Sharing joy alike
feels that passion'll soon be national. Love is sweeping the country. There never was so much love.
You're listening to the opening program of our third season of What Makes It Great with host Rob Capello. Here he's joined by Sally Wolfert and Michael Winter in The Songs of George and Ira Gershwin. There will now be a short question and answer session with questions taken from the audience, and then probably that encore that Rob promised.
All right. Chance of a lifetime. Anything you want to know from anyone. Who's got... Yes, go ahead. By the way, this will be on the radio. No pressure. Go ahead. Go ahead. When did they stop writing the introductions was his question. You know, the interesting thing about those introductions, a lot of it had to do with technology, and of course you'll read this in my new book next year. A lot of it had to do with the technology. In other words, since recordings were short, a lot of the reasons that these songs survived was they were performed by band leaders and they became pop hits. Because the records were short, the first thing they would do would be to cut the verse. And so the songs gradually became just the chorus itself. Also, when jazz musicians started to take this up, all they would work with was the chorus. So gradually it got eliminated. It had a function in the actual show itself when it actually set the scene. But when these became just popular songs that could be heard on the radio or played by a dance band, all that actually mattered were the choruses. So it actually became eliminated by technology long before it actually was eliminated in the theater itself. Question for anyone? You've got two Broadway stars here. Anyone? Yes, sure, go ahead.
Did the singers learn anything tonight that changed their approach to the material?
Oh, it was revelatory. Did the singers learn anything tonight that changed the approach to the material?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been doing these for a bit of time with Rob, and in the very beginning, the idea of singing the ink, like what's on the page, was just kind of, really difficult. Because, you know, we put so much style in things, we backphrase, but the point of these is to sing the ink, and there's a great freedom in that, because obviously the composers made choices, especially back then. Now, you know, the younger, more modern theater composers write in a lot of the phrasing, the backphrasings, the way they want it to be sung. They write it into the chart, whereas during this time, it was kind of more straightforward.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's really been hard for the singers, and one of the reasons I love having people like Sally and Michael do this, is that to get people to actually sing what's printed is enormously difficult. Without naming any names, I've done these programs oftentimes with some really great popular music singers who simply cannot bring themselves to actually sing what's on the printed page. It's wonderful interpretations, and that's not a bad way to do the music, to make it your own, to change the rhythms, to sing it around. I mean, Barbara Streisand type approach. It doesn't mean it's bad at all, but what I like to try to do is get back to what the composers actually wrote. So they actually sang tonight, and you probably never hear it again, all the rhythms that are written in that music exactly the way they do them. And it's really a learning process to sort of get inside the music that way. One of the things that's very different, and it shows up in the orchestrations. In those days, all the orchestrations of these songs had some instrument in the pit that was doubling the melody. And one of the reasons that singers had to sing more accurately was there was some violin or clarinet that was literally playing what the composer wrote. And that was one of the ways that the composer ensured that his melody would be heard correctly, because even if it was wrong on stage, somebody out there was saying, here's what it really sounds like. Nowadays, you would absolutely never do that. If you were a Broadway orchestrator and you doubled the melody and instrument, you would be fired instantly. And the only question is, would you be fired by the lead singer or the actual composer himself? Because nowadays you leave it blank and the singer is free to interpret as it's done. But if you go back to those original orchestrations, every single one of them doubles the melody in some instrument and the rhythm is absolutely precise, and that's why they sang them more clearly. But to me, there's a whole world in the, as I tried to show you, when we change one rhythm, you change the whole song. Now, that doesn't mean it's not a good song when it's someone else's, but it's no longer Gershwin's. So we tried very hard tonight to really respect the rhythm. And I think what's great about them is some singers feel straitjacketed by that as opposed to liberated. But I think that they did a fantastic job of taking those rhythms and making it Gershwin's kind of music rather than someone else's. Yes?
So did the Gershwins have a particular singer in mind when they wrote the songs?
I'll always answer everything unless you want to jump right in. Yes, almost all the time, things were tailored to specific performers. You know, particularly someone like Ethel Merman. Literally, she would absolutely demand a certain kind of thing. So in those days, performer was king, and one of the great talents you had to have as a composer was not only writing music, but writing music that fit particular performers. So yes, these almost always were written. In fact, Gertrude Lawrence, you know, a lot was written particularly for her, someone to watch over me, because she didn't have a huge voice. And you'll hear many Broadway stories about composers taking advantages of the actual limitations of their singers, all the way up through Sondheim, you know, Sendin' the Clowns, which I think we did hear a couple of years ago, literally written for the limited voice that Glynis Johns had. So yes, I think one of the marks in those days of great Broadway songwriters is performers were king, and you wrote and tailored your music to specific performers. One of the things people loved about Astaire was that he actually sang the printed rhythm. I mean, he really was very, very faithful to what the composers wrote, and that's why a lot of composers love to write for him.
I mean, it's still the case now with Broadway shows, yeah. And, you know, they go through a longer development process, and so each performer that is part of the development process, whether it be a workshop or a lab, they put their mark on it, because the composers are very much interested in using what their singer, their actor has, right. And so it's still, I mean, there are certainly shows now where people are writing for well-known, you know, Broadway stars. I know that's an oxymoron nowadays, but still, a TV star coming to Broadway. But anyway.
Anyone up there? I always forget up there. Yes, up there. Go ahead, sure.
Is there any predicate in the 19th century to Gershwin's changing of the chords and use changing of the rhythms?
You mean, are there precursors? Yes, I mean, definitely, you know, you can find some of it, but it gets much more sophisticated. I mean, there is a whole opening chapter in my new book on precursors, and you can read all about it. But though there is some precursors, it's much more sophisticated here. You would find that kind of writing much more in opera or operetta, that kind of sophisticated harmony. But the popular music of the 19th century wasn't nearly as sophisticated as that kind of reharmonization. And you really find it a lot in Gershwin, who had, in spite of the kind of image of him as a kind of idiot savant, he actually had an enormous amount of training and studied composition quite a bit. It wasn't by accident that he was able to write things like Porgy and Bess and Rhapsody in Blue and Concerto F. He actually studied quite a bit. Maybe one more. Oh, yeah, go ahead. Sure.
Is the structure of these songs uniquely American?
He wants to know if the structure of these songs is uniquely American. One of the things about them is it's very common. It becomes a kind of standard in America because, in a way, if you think about it, it's perfectly adapted to an easy listening public. In other words, you've got an idea, it's eight measures. It's really easy to follow an eight-measure idea. Then you get to hear that eight-measure idea again. Then you have one moment where you go away, but only that is eight measures, and then you come back and you have the comfort of hearing it a third time. So in some ways, music that has had an idea go away and come back to it has been there from time immemorial. If you look in the 13 and 1400s, you know, you've got rondos, which are fundamentally about that principle of a catchy idea, go somewhere else, come back to it. But the short economy of it does tend to become uniquely American, and it is a kind of a trademark of those Broadway songs. And many composers fought against it later, and you can see that, you know, when you get to the 40s and 50s. Or like when, we've never done Richard Rodgers here, but I did recently a program on Soliloquy from Carousel. I mean, that's a complete break with any kind of traditional form, and that's a whole different ball of fish. But in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, that AABA thing was extremely common. Very, very common.
I have a question, actually, yes. I meant to ask.
Would you like to ask him?
No, okay. No. Yes.
This is a question for you. Go
where,
ahead. Yes.
Where did you get your frames? No, I'm kidding. No. I've sung this song many times in Can't Take That Away From You. The lyric, other than rhyming, the way you hold your knife, that always sounded such a strange lyric. Is there any story behind that?
I think, it, you know, just imagine there's a way. You know how some people just hold a cup of tea like this?
Yeah.
But, you know, the kind of delicate way she held. I mean, the knife is such a savage thing,
yeah.
But the way she held that savage thing delicately.
See, I always think of it like she's like...
Well, we have to interpret that the way you hold your knife. For the next performance.
Yeah, that's, right? Yeah.
That kind of psycho influence there, yeah. I know you've been here for a long time. Would you like one more song to go home to? This is the perfect final song, and it's actually the last song that Gershwin ever wrote. it seemed appropriate way to finish. And when you listen to the lyrics, you will think they were written yesterday.
Seems to be lasting, but that isn't our affair. We've got something permanent, I mean in the way we care. It's very is here to stay,
not for a year,
but ever and a day. The radio and the telephone
and the movies that we know may just be passing fancies,
and in time may go.
Rob Capello with Sally Wilfert and Michael Winter, his special guests, the songs of George and Ira Gershwin on this opening episode of our third season of What Makes It Great, one of our most popular programs here on the Classical Network. We want to thank a few people for making these broadcasts of What Makes It Great possible. Of course, Rob Capello, also Lydia Kontos, Executive Director of Kauffman Music Center, Emily Krell, Merkin Concert Hall Producer and Managing Director, and Joan Jastrzebski, Communications Director. Our recording engineer for this program was Bill Moss. The next episode of What Makes It Great will come your way in January of the new year. What Makes It Great is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.